Hello, everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, episode 349, the Year in Review special for 2014, our last episode for the year. My name's Patrick Gray. We will be taking a break over the southern summer, returning sometime around mid-January. Kind of looking forward to the break, I've got to be honest. Big thanks to Bug Crowd for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. Bug Crowd's CEO, Casey Ellis, will be along a little bit later on. He's going to chat about how 2014 was for him and also talk about what might be on the horizon in 2015 in the security discipline. And you know what? This is kind of a funny year to be reviewing. In 2010, we had Stuxnet and the Manning dump. In 2011, we had Lulzsec causing mayhem. In 2012, they all got caught, but not before the FBI supervised the hack of Stratfor and subsequent dump of its emails all over the WikiLeaks website. 2012 was also the year that Saudi Aramco got hacked. That was a very interesting incident. I thought that at the time, and it's doubly interesting since the Sony incident of this year. In 2013, we had the APT1 report, we had Ed Snowden, the RSA-ECC controversy, and the Target hack. And in 2014, what did we have? Mostly just a shitload of mayhem and ownage. So unlike other years, there isn't just this big, clear theme that we can all point to at the end of the year and say, this is what 2014 was about. But we've still got plenty to talk about. We had some massive breaches, some epic bugs like Shellshock and Heartbleed. But I'm sad to say, this sort of mayhem is kind of business as usual in InfoSec. I mean, Sony getting hacked by a crew that could be out of North Korea is probably the coolest single news item out of 2014. But it looks like a remarkably similar crew pulled off a remarkably similar raid against Aramco back in 2012. So it's not something we haven't actually seen before. Maybe not in America, but you know, it's been seen elsewhere, North Korea or no North Korea. In terms of outright ownage, probably the biggest ticket item throughout the year was the leak of celebrities' naughty photos to the internet, thanks to Apple allowing certain iCloud APIs to be brute-forced. That was certainly something that made big news in the mainstream media. We also saw the so-called Operation Onimus against underground marketplaces, resulting in a bunch of hidden services going dark and a few ringleaders thrown in jail. But you know what? We haven't had a single massive news event that we can all point to as the big ticket item of 2014. But nonetheless, a theme has emerged anyway, and it has shades of 2011 when Lulzsec were running riot. There's an increasing realization among the general population and mainstream media that the technology that underpins networked computing just can't be trusted. Naughty pictures on iPhones can't be trusted. POS systems can't be trusted. SSL implementations can't be trusted. Tor, maybe, can't be trusted. Even Bash can't be trusted. Not even poor old Bash. So if anything, I think 2014 marked a major backward step in terms of the confidence the world has in information security and information systems. But will that mean security will improve now that the awareness is there? I actually don't think so. Several years ago, I was being interviewed by another journalist here in Australia. They were interested in the 2011 blog post I'd written called Why We Secretly Love Lulzsec. That post went pretty viral at the time, and I wound up being interviewed by a bunch of mainstream journos, and in particular, they were interested in one thing I'd said in the piece, something along the lines of, there is no security online. When I was pressed on that, I said, you know what? When a technology takes off, culture changes. We're not going to be able to lock this stuff down properly ever. It'll only ever be good enough, never great. And the thing is, whether you're looking at petrol engine cars, telephones, text messaging and email, hell, the printing press, with all of these innovations, we don't wind up shaping the technology. The technology winds up shaping us. And that's where I've arrived at the end of 2014. I can't see computing technology getting radically more secure in the near future, but I can see us getting used to massive data breaches, leaked data and epic hacks. We might be able to kick the can down the road a little bit, but the fact is there will always be plenty of targets out there who hold sensitive information and don't look after it well. I want to illustrate that point by mangling a bit of accepted wisdom that our industry clings to. You've heard them say it, you don't have to outrun the tiger, you just have to outrun the guy next to you. But instead of that, imagine that there's a shitload of tigers and a shitload of people, and the tigers run faster than at least half the people. Oh, and there's a handful of very fast tigers that can outrun almost anyone. And that's where we are in 2014. The Tigers have plenty of fresh meat to gorge on, you know, easy meat. And the Alpha Tigers over at NSA, GCHQ and, you know, all of the equivalent agencies everywhere, they can dine on whatever flesh they choose. That accepted wisdom just doesn't hold. You know, I wrote my first article on information security for Melbourne's Age newspaper in 2001, and I've been covering InfoSec ever since. And I'm gradually turning into that guy from the movie Network. You know, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. But then again, so's the rest of the media. Let's listen to what the mainstream TV networks made of all of the big InfoSec headlines over 2014.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad.
Now, over 500 million computers may be at risk from a new software bug called Shell Shock.
Is this hyperbole, or is it just, or is it true? Is this really as bad as those quotes suggest?
An internet security bug called Heartbleed is to blame. It was discovered accidentally in an encryption service used by two-thirds of the websites to protect your information.
Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it.
If you've used the web in the last 2 years, you are vulnerable to hackers who could easily gain access to your bank accounts and any passwords that you have used.
Cyber attack on JPMorgan Chase. With a bank this big, it raises big questions about the safety of personal accounts and national security.
And this breaking news affecting millions of us, including me. Home Depot now saying its credit breach affects 56 million cards. It's almost as big as the Target breach. People on
streets, I want you to get mad.
Sony Pictures reportedly investigating whether North Korea actually hacked into the studio's network.
So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs.
Do we even know who is this 4chan person?
I'm sorry that I'm laughing because it's not funny. It's awful if this has happened to you. This has become sort of our new reality with the cloud.
With the cloud. That's what I wanted to get to. Which listen, is... A lot of people have...
We've all done these things.
The National Crime Agency says it's arrested six people in an investigation targeting the so-called dark web.
And we're telling you earlier in the news pack, of course, about a scary, very, very scary virus that's actually hitting some computers around the world.
So the virus is called Reagan. It's this super spyware.
We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy.
Campaigners made these discoveries from internal Gamma documents published by WikiLeaks. They show users of the spy software contacting Gamma for help when they had problems targeting people.
This is very serious because you are talking about people's lives. People have been killed, people have been tortured.
I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Ampersounds equals yes. Slash. Every I can't remember them all. I spend most of my
life. Use a sentence. Mary had a little lamb. Change Mary to Google.
Until you've got to put a dot or a symbol or something else. Then it's Mary had a little lamb equals.
So we felt safe going to websites with a little padlock in that address bar. Well, you shouldn't have.
There's not a lot you can do. Well, you absolutely have to have good passwords because it's looking like this guy who got in literally ran a program that just runs through every word in the dictionary.
Under pressure. Under pressure.
Well, that was their view, but here on this program, we took a pretty different editorial line. We spent much of the year unpacking the fallout of the Snowden leaks, as well as covering bread and butter InfoSec. Here's how Adam and I saw things over 2014. And Adam, we begin this week with the news that the US Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, is having a good old-fashioned QQ.
Yeah, he is having a bit of a sook. He's complaining that apparently America's terrorist adversaries are changing their behaviours, having gone to school, quote unquote, on the Snowden leaks. Well, I'm shocked and horrified. I mean, the fact that Bin Laden successfully did avoid for some time their intelligence apparatus suggests they may have already started to go to school before Snowden. But yes, he's having a bit of a sook. personally, I liked Turbo Panda, which was the Huawei backdoors, and there's a souffle trough, which, you know, that sounds good, a trough full of souffle. To resist the naked internet hegemony, we will draw up international regulations, strengthen technology safeguards, but we will also severely punish the pawns of the villain.
Yeah, yeah, I'd like to see more rhetoric like this in Western government.
Yeah,
I mean, it does seem like GCHQ basically does whatever the hell they feel like. The good news, of course, is that Putin was using Yahoo Chat to organize his invasion of Crimea.
Yeah, it's beyond surveillance state and into just...
Surveillance planet?
Yeah, I mean, that way, it's the dystopian cyberpunk future is what that is. They've probably got some, you know, internal CIA YouTube clone.
Yeah.
You can, you know, subscribe to the torture channel or
you
something.
Scream.
This is
let's laugh anyway. Oh. I'd be so disappointed, though, if it turns out that the country that they're tapping all of the phone calls in is Afghanistan, because, you know...
all seven of them, you
That's
reckon.
Like... Well, yeah, exactly. It's like tapping two square blocks in New York, you know what I mean? It's not exactly anything to brag about.
The fact is, once you can packet sniff the internet, you know, of course you're going to want to use it for, you know, everything that it is useful for. And
because terrorism. Kind of
thing, because terrorism, right?
Anyway. Yeah, you got to love that. We're not sure this is legal, but whatevs.
Yeah.
It won't really be a problem unless someone leaks all these documents. You know, Apparently, if you're a reader of Linux Journal, this is now considered an extremist forum, which, you know, is funnily enough correct in a lot of ways. But what are we to make of all of this?
Mt. Cox is essentially a, you know, very large multiplayer Bitcoin wallet.
Don't think I don't notice that you keep calling it Mt. Cox. I do.
That's just my Kiwi accent.
Yeah,
I can't help it. Yeah, smart move on their behalf, because that was really not a particularly wise choice for Cockton. They have indeed. Apparently someone has been busting into Snapchat accounts. Methods currently unknown. Snapchat are asserting that it's just plain password guessing. And they're messaging all their contacts with pictures of fruit smoothies and a link to a recipe for a fruit smoothie. Now, it's nice to see the kids are still doing this for the lulz and, you know, not just, you know, pictures of their cocks.
I'm detecting a theme this week.
Via the mobile interface, you know, if you had pictures of cocks in your Instagram account that you had marked as private, then, yeah, you could actually use this just if someone, you know, browsed your site, ran JavaScript, and have them set those to public.
Yeah.
You started this, buddy. You started it. It's the whole Mt. Cox thing is just such a cluster. You're going to have to edit now. Such a cluster.
I think that is the correct term. I think
it probably is the correct term, isn't it?
Silk Road version 2 is no more, and a couple of other drug marketplaces have been taken down as well.
DEFCON of Silk Road 2 is, apparently been arrested in California. Looks like your average sort of, you know, Web 2.0 startup hippie. and yeah, he's going to have a bad time by the sound of things.
Yeah, he looks more like the sort of guy you'd expect to serve you your three-quarter soy latte, doesn't he?
Yeah, exactly.
He used the email address blake@benthal.net to register for his service provision.
I know. You'd think, right, if you were going to start Silk Road 2.0, which, you know, a little bit of a target for law enforcement, you might consider that wasn't best choice ever.
Now, of course, the big news while I was away is this massive dump of very private personal photos, like nude photos, pornographic photos in some cases, of Hollywood celebrities. We've got a situation where the InfoSec community has been telling people for years and years and years, back up, back up, back up. And now this happens and we say, oh, well, don't back up to iCloud with your photos. do you know what I mean? Like, it's an emperor has no clothes moment. Do not even think about investing in chip and pin. Magstripe is the future. Way to go, USA. Awesome.
You got to wonder whether, you know, Cloudflare and DDoS have the same sort of symbiosis going on.
Yeah, well, you know, what is it? Getting a brick through your window with a note on it that says Bob's Glaziers, you know, that sort of thing.
You know, when someone's turning the heater on and off in your house, or, you know, turning on and off the, you know, the heater in your tropical fish tank or something, you know, that's stuff that really does affect people out in meat space.
Fishicide.
Exactly, yeah.
Cyber fishicide, no less. Now, a Twitter account popped up called Whale Dump. Maybe it's someone that we might have thrown a few beers down with, you know, various KiwiCons. I would not be surprised if that were the case. But look,
that's the thing that drives me nuts, but it has to be someone I know. This mask malware actually used a bug in Kaspersky to avoid detection. So, you know, that's a little bit of a finger in the old eyeball
In keeping with these guys not being criminal masterminds, two of them got arrested in Russia. I mean, how bad a cyber criminal do you need to be to actually get arrested for cybercrime in Russia?
I know. I was thinking exactly the same thing as I read it. So the Yahoo toolbar, which I'm just going to stay up front, has no purpose in life and no one should have, and it should die in a screaming, you know, nuclear death fire, attempts to, you know, improve websites that you're browsing to by injecting content into the DOM tree of your browser to make it Yahoo-ish. I don't know. Put exclamation marks on things. Whatever the fuck it does.
If you're a cyber James Bond, don't use VirusTotal to check your stuff, you know? Like...
Krebs has some screenshots of the various some of the control panels for this malware. Mm. So if you want to see what it looks like to go steal $1 billion, that's what it looks like.
Yeah, it looks like they could actually, if they were making that much, they could probably have invested in a little bit more design. But anyway,
some prettier CSS, perhaps.
So he kind of owned them through their help desk software, which is, good job.
The kid actually tweeted it at TweetDeck. Which is then that got turned into the worm. So, you know, it was quite a good example of, you know, the modern full disclosure approach, I guess.
And I'm sure the founders of Twitter are so upset by this that it almost interrupted their golf game on their mega yacht.
Pretty much, yes. I'm only going to play the front nine on the yacht instead of the whole course today, just because of the humanity of it all.
Yeah, I mean, his two handles were Batman 73, year of his birth. Well done, guy. And the other one was anonymous as shit. This tale of Sony woe just keeps rolling.
It's just getting more and more bizarre by the day. I mean, now there's speculation in the media that this is the doing of none other than the axis of evil itself, North Korea, which... I don't even know.
I never for a million years would have thought that this would actually wind up sounding like a plausible scenario. But it's sounding like a plausible scenario.
I agree. Right? Unfortunately, it is.
That would be a real stretch under the international laws of conflict to actually call this an act of war. But it's certainly an act of FU, right? A bit of a news selection there, some excerpts from this year's show featuring Adam Boileau, and in one instance, The Gruck, who was kind enough to do a few news spots this year. So let's move on into the guts of the program now, and instead of recapping the big news items of 2014 in this edition, I thought I'd do something different this year and just look back over my favourite interviews from this year's podcast. Now, I have one very clear favourite from the year, and that was an extended chat I had with Brian Snow, a 34-year veteran of America's NSA. He was a technical director of three different groups inside the agency before his retirement in the mid-2000s. Now, when the Snowden story broke last year, I didn't get in touch with Brian for his thoughts. I knew he wouldn't want to talk about it publicly. Not yet, anyway. There was way too much dust in the air, and I have way too much respect for Brian to put him on the spot like that. So I waited. Then, with the dust mostly settled in August this year, we spoke about the Snowden leaks and how he saw them. It was a remarkably candid interview that really helped me understand how some of the NSA's more controversial programs actually got started. It gave me fascinating insight into the culture of the NSA and how changes to institutional culture can lead to unexpected results. Here's a couple of minutes from that interview. And I don't want to be a savior
anymore. You ain't gonna get you what you want. There was a real disjunction between the American populace, what they would tolerate, and what they were hearing as presented through the Snowden episodes. Clearly, whatever we were doing was found to be very unpleasant to the American public. And that's not the way we're supposed to function. NSA is built to protect them, not to abuse them. And we are supposed to do stuff overseas and not at home against citizens, at least not without warrants. And typically, I think this was a change in culture over time, but it was incremental and crept up on us. It wasn't one day we're doing this and the next day we're doing something completely different.
I understand that, but was there a radical cultural shift after 9/11?
I don't think radical is the right word, but it was reasonably abrupt. A lot more focus came on it very quickly. There was a press on us, both from congressional types, and I believe they were pressed very much by their people who voted for them, of keep us safe. It was very traumatic. 9/11 was a traumatic event for the United States. And people were really stunned and shocked. And didn't even think, my God, this couldn't happen here. It did. And there was a very strong feeling of, I'm not safe. What the hell can we do? Some part of the government would come to us, FBI, CIA, a congressman, whatever, and say, what can you do against foreign people coming in? So that got the ball rolling of the foreign body on our soil. So now we're listening to things on our soil. And we have the linguistic capability to figure out what the hell they're talking about. And now we're just listening to people on our soil. Our citizens are on our soil, too. It was a gray area. And I was not in the room when these decisions were made. These are political decisions made back and forth between the management cadre and Congress and others. I was a techie helping to deliver the hardware to get things done. But there was incredible pressure on us, on the CIA, on the FBI, anybody who either carried a gun or carried a microphone or had some capability that could be deployed against the bad guys who were trying to hurt us. Because the citizenry just simply didn't want to see that happen again at any scale. Okay.
Now, I think that interview was great for setting some context around the Snowden leaks from the NSA point of view. But it was this year's chat with Yahoo CSO Alex Stamos that helped us understand Snowden's impact on business. Here's what he told us back in August.
I was pretty interested in obviously stuff that's going on in our government and around the world and about, you know, mass surveillance as well as the ability for governments to use the internet against their citizens. And that's something that I've been upset about a long time. And you get to touch upon that kind of stuff when you work in consulting because you find bugs or you get to work on security tools that maybe people use. But when the opportunity came up to work for a company that has something like a billion users, that seemed like the best chance to have a positive impact on people around the world. And so that's, you know, I thought you can't say no when that opportunity comes up.
Now, how much of your job is driven from a board level desire to minimize the fallout from the Snowden leaks?
Our board and our CEO, just like all the other tech companies, understand that user trust is an existential issue for Silicon Valley, right? The entire model of the internet in which we provide you free services and you entrust us with information and every once in a while you click on an ad, that deal is something that people have finally thought about what the security implications are. And I think that's great. I'm glad the consumers are thinking about that, and I'm glad they're being picky. I think us and all the other tech companies are going to have to find some kind of working relationship with the government where we can work towards the goals that we share of, like, people who are doing accounts takeover and phishing and spamming and selling people diet products that hurt them, that we want to make sure those people go to jail while not opening the door to the abuse of that relationship again. I do what I
want and I want what I see. Yahoo CISO Alex Stamos there, giving us a bit of insight into how the Snowden leaks have impacted on people in his position and Silicon Valley more broadly. Now we come to a somewhat odd interview I did this year with none other than Super Troll Andrew Orenheimer, aka Weave. He'd just been released from prison after having his conviction for hacking AT&T overturned on appeal. Now, I think most people in the InfoSec industry would realise that the charges against Weave were kind of bullshit and he never really deserved to be locked up. For that, anyway. Days after his release, I spoke to him via Skype and he didn't hold back.
This is America, and if there's anything that my country loves to do, it is frivolously throw people in jail and frivolously litigate. These are our best talents as a civilization, I think. It's pretty much prisons and law is all we have left now, because that's just how the United States is. We don't make anything anymore. We're lazy. We're parasitic. My country is just useless, and anytime anyone points that out and disrupts, like, the culture of silence and propriety, then they go to prison. Over there in Australia, you're not safe either, because as we've seen with, like, Ken.com and, like, other people, they maintain the right to indict you and seize all your money and shut down your business wherever you are in the world. So they are utter sociopaths, and they are a gigantic threat to pretty much every decent hardworking person in the world. Like, the best thing, the only thing you can do to avoid the U.S. government f***ing you is to get a job waiting tables. AT&T did not push this indictment. The so-called victim did not think it was victimized. This is the FBI and the Department of Justice end-to-end calling this. Every single engineer that's taken a look at this has said that this is ridiculous. They aren't going to get a single bit of kindness from me ever again. No corporate entity will ever receive any mercy from me, you know? Like, because if they're going to litigate, if they're going to point a gun in my face, I really think that we should point guns back in their face. If the government is trying to protect corporations and protect this culture that they've tried to establish by force, then I think we need to escalate the conflict against corporations. AT&T, pretty much they stood by and watched the federal government f*** me. So f*** them, you know, f*** their business model. At this point, anything that happens against them or pretty much any other major Fortune 500 company is fair game. You know, I think that we need to escalate the conflict. I'm willing to go back to prison. I'm going to continue doing exactly what I did. And the tone is not going to be any nicer. In fact, the tone before was funny. Like, now the tone is going to be a little bit meaner than it was before. I will not respond to the bullying of federal agents. I'm going to continue what I'm doing, and I'm going to continue to do it until justice is brought to them and their families. It's not like I have anything to behave myself for. I have no incentives.
Well, I would have thought staying out of prison would be an incentive.
I will not respond to terrorism. And to use violence in pursuit of political silence is an act of terrorism. So no, I'm not going to play the government's little game and quiet myself up because they expect me to be afraid of continuing to be tortured in prison. It's not going to happen. They all deserve to die, and I hope to I hope to continue infuriating them.
Sometime after this interview was published, Weave reportedly had a 4.5-inch swastika tattooed on his chest, moved to Lebanon and started an online tirade that still continues about wanting to exterminate Jews in gas ovens along with blacks. Charming. Now, keep in mind this is a guy who thrives on outrage. It's his oxygen. So I've spent a bit of time wondering if this is just more trolling or if Weave is actually sincere in those beliefs. But here's the thing. Where the bullshit stops and the person starts, it doesn't matter. We have to judge people on what they say they think, not what we suppose they think. And if we judge him along those lines, it's pretty clear that Weave is nothing more than a colossal prick. And he's actually unknowingly started a new saying among people I know. Never go full Weave, man. So congratulations, guy. You've set the gold standard for online douchebaggery, and that particular bar is set pretty high indeed. Yet, somehow, I think you'll be quite pleased with that title. So what else in 2014? Bug branding. We had a great catch-up with Neil Mehta of Heartbleed fame this year. Now, as far as I know, that was the only interview Neil has ever done on the Heartbleed bug that he found. There's not much behind his media shyness. Interviews just make him nervous. They make plenty of people nervous. So, he just doesn't do them. He only did one with me because we have some long-standing mutual friends. Now, as it turns out, he was quite surprised that Heartbleed was portrayed as the harbinger of the imminent bugpocalypse. So was I, really. Bleeding hearts
and they can't stop flowing. I'm a little bit less enthusiastic about how serious of a bug it was than some other people out there. So I was a little surprised by the reaction. I think a lot of that had to do with some of the marketing around the bug that Codenomicon did. So a logo and a great name goes a long way. I didn't have any of those. So
yeah, well, and it's set the trend, right? Because now we've got Shell Shock.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, it's a great name. The bug itself is very serious, and I think it's more serious than Heartbleed, but it depends on, again, what information you're trying to guard and what you consider valuable. So if you consider your SSL keys more valuable, you might be able to get them both ways. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, I'm curious, though, because, I mean, both of these bugs, right, they do have some common elements. I think, you know, common element number one is they're not memory exploitation bugs. And this is interesting to me because this is going back to, you know, memory exploitation has been terribly, terribly hip for, like, the last 15 years. But it seems like the larger impact bugs these days have more to do with just, you know, logic flaws in software, right?
Yeah. I think that they tend to be overly represented in the bugs that are exploited quickly, the bugs that are exploited widely and quite successfully. The truth is that memory corruption exploitation is just simply becoming a much more specialized field. It's harder to do. There's a lot more work that goes into it. And so if it takes weeks to develop an exploit for a bug, just a matter of fact that it's going to be less popular. There's less people are going to do it. Less people are going to be willing to give away their exploits. You're going to see less of it used out there in the wild. Whereas with bugs like shell shock, you find out that your shell is doing unexpected things in unexpected places. You don't necessarily know where all those places are. And you certainly, you know, prior to recently, didn't expect it to be executing code out of environment variables. So if you can type, you can exploit it.
This whole Heartbleed thing made me think back to Dan Kaminsky's apparent planet-melting bind bugs a few years back. What I found hilarious about those ones is a remarkably similar set of bugs in Bind had been uncovered and patched about a year earlier with zero fanfare. And you know what? Even applying brand names to threats isn't new. Code Red in 2001, anyone? It's just that the approach is back and it still works. I think that without the branding, Heartbleed would have been something that still would have got plenty of attention in the security media as being a pretty awful bug and something you want to patch pronto. And that would have been that. It wouldn't have leapt the gap into the mainstream press. So Heartbleed was the first big brand of 2014, then along came Shellshock. Combined, I'm calling these two Shartbleed. Then we had Poodle, which was, you know, a bit of a non-event. But I don't think the branding thing is as new as some other people think. And part of me thinks it's silly, but another part of me thinks, hey, whatever works. Awareness is good. I just hope it's not a cry wolf scenario. So what else happened in 2014? Well, XP support ended. Charlie Miller came onto the show to talk about hacking cars, which is cool because he hadn't spoken about that with anyone else, anywhere. He's been, like, really quiet about that. The full disclosure mailing list closed, then it reopened again. Oh, here's a cool story that a lot of people have sort of forgotten about, but the US charged, in absentia, a whole bunch of Chinese army guys from the APT-1 crew with hacking America. That was cool. We even got Hugh White on the show to talk about that. He's an ex-prime ministerial advisor and the first ever director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. He also used to work at the Office of National Assessments here in Australia, and he's a very well-regarded China expert. Here's what he had to say. I'm looking for
the party people. It's primarily a symbolic move. I can't imagine that anyone in the US system that believes they've got any chance at all of getting these guys in front of an American court. And so I think, their reasoning is they want to find a way to show the Chinese, and perhaps more importantly, Americans, that they're serious about this. The problem for them is that when you show you're serious by doing something which is very unlikely to succeed, you end up looking like a goose. I think this is a way of the Justice Department and maybe the US government more broadly feeling they're doing something about a problem or conveying the impression to others that they're doing something about a problem without actually doing it. And, of course, the more they actually do, the more they risk retaliation from China. And I think that'd be unwise to believe that China doesn't have some interesting ways of retaliating. You know, the most obvious thing would be to start imposing limitations on US companies operating in China in ways that would affect the commercial interests of those companies. Presumably, one of the things that's driving the government, the US government, to this least superficially tough stance are concerns from US companies. But the US companies that are really deeply involved in the China market would understand that this kind of posturing doesn't necessarily get a good commercial result. So I think it's likely to end up being counterproductive. And one of the great risks for America is in trying to show that it's strong, it ends up showing that it's weak. Because you posture and you sort of beat your chest and then you say, well, what's happened? And the answer is nothing's happened. It made it harder for the US politically and rhetorically to castigate Beijing for a global intelligence collection effort when Snowden had done so much to reveal America's own global intelligence collection effort. But I don't actually think that's the thing that's really stopped the US taking effective action. I think it's more the nature of the issue. So the fact is the United States has already got a track record of beating its chest about this, but not actually swinging on the vine. You know, I think that's they're risking doing that again.
What else? What else? Well, I also caught up with Captain Internet himself, Chris Segoyan of the ACLU. When I was in the USA back in February, he was boycotting the RSA conference to attend TrustyCon, which, as it turned out, was actually a pretty cool event. He explains.
I mean, the signal-to-noise ratio at this conference is great. So I think bringing together a bunch of really smart people, both on stage and a bunch of really smart people in the audience, who are concerned about these kinds of threats, I think is a positive thing. You know, it would have been great if it hadn't taken the RSA incident for this to happen, but I'm really glad that we now have an event focused on this, and I hope that it'll happen again next year. And I really do think that, you know, in the wake of the Snowden disclosures, the system of trust that the internet relies on has been ultimately undermined by what the NSA is doing. And I think tech companies are going to have to work hard to regain some of that trust. And I think as a technical community, we have to start building our systems to be able to withstand these kinds of threats. I mean, the government essentially has pseudo power, and we need to do everything we can to design our technology to be resistant to that kind of power.
I also caught up with Marcus Renham face-to-face at RSA to talk about the emerging theme of that conference.
Marcus Renham, threat intelligence.
Oh, big data, threat intelligence, snort, APT, APT, big data, threat intelligence, snort, snort, snort.
Yeah, but threat intelligence, threat intelligence, threat intelligence, threat intelligence.
Snort, APT.
Thank you very much for your time.
Always a pleasure.
We also heard from Matt Solnick about his absolutely terrifying carrier software bugs that can own all the things. Look that one up if you missed it. It's really bad. We spoke to Dave DeWalt, the CEO of FireEye and former president of McAfee, about big business. Oh, and how could I forget? Newsweek found Satoshi Nakamoto. But it was the wrong Satoshi Nakamoto. That was fun. Oh, and the US DOJ thinks that encrypted smartphones are for pedos and terrorists. What else happened? All the POS systems in the world apparently got owned. That was cool. But the whole thing just keeps spinning, doesn't it? There's always plenty to talk about. That's why I have a job. I'm going to wrap this up in a moment, this year in review. But before we take you to this week's sponsor interview, I want to say a few things at the end of the year. Firstly, thanks to everyone who's helped out with the show over the year. First and foremost, to Adam Boileau, whose commentary on this show over the last few years has helped make it so successful. To all those in the background, Adam P, Pipes, Gold and Snelly, among others, thanks for your help. Thanks to all the guests as well for giving up their time to make us all smarter. To Virtual Office in Sydney for providing us with such excellent hosting. And to the sponsors for keeping the whole thing kicking over. Last and definitely not least, big thanks to you, the audience. If you don't keep listening, this thing stops. So thanks so much for giving up your time each week to tune in. And I've noticed something about this podcast audience over the last few years, which is actually pretty awesome. 8 years ago, you were just smart people in security in a world that really didn't care. But flash forward to now, and there is a substantial chunk of you who are actually running the industry. You are an influential bunch. From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, from London to Johannesburg, Sydney to Auckland, you guys are really kicking ass and taking names. It's another reason this show is a success. Sponsors want to fund this show because you are among the most important people in the industry. Good job. Keep it up. And again, thank you. And that is my year in review. Well, before we go, we've got time for one last sponsor interview for 2014. This week's show, as I mentioned earlier, is brought to you by BugCrowd, crowdsourced security. They'll run your bug bounty program for you. They'll handle responsible disclosure from their 13,000-strong registered testing team. They'll handle the disclosure from them to you. And they'll even run crowdsourced application tests for you. You can check them out at bugcrowd.com. BugCrowd is based in the USA, but its founder and CEO, Casey Ellis, is Australian. He joined me via Skype to wrap up this year's season of Risky Business, and I started off by asking him, if this is the year that security finally got taken seriously by the general population out there, but then again, we keep saying that every year, maybe they'll take us seriously now. Maybe they will. Maybe.
We do say it every year. It is kind of, you know, I think hopeless optimism in some instances, but yeah.
Well, we're waiting for everyone to take security seriously and Linux on the desktop.
Linux, yeah, 2015 will be the year of Linux on the desktop. I guess the thing is that I'm not sure, you know, I'd have to actually look into this and drill into it in terms of the number of people that have been personally affected by the things that have gone on. But I do think the number of people personally affected and the way that they've been personally affected, you know, 2014 has been a standout year for that. Like it's less, probably less obvious over in Australia. But, you know, the number of people in the US that have had to have their credit card reissued, you know, in some cases multiple times because of the different retail breaches that have gone on this year, for example. That's like the rate of that and the fact that it's all seemed to happen in big spurts. When you're getting a message out to a market or when a group of people's becoming aware of a particular issue, the more people that can become aware of that at the same time basically deepens the traction of that message, if that makes sense. So The fact that you've got tons of people, you know, oh, crap, this Target thing's happened. Oh, crap, my credit card's been reissued. Oh, mine too, da-da-da-da-da. Yeah, there's an acceleration in the message that I think is a result of that.
Yeah, and it's also, by the way, here's a nude photo of J-Law, right?
There you go. Yeah, then there's that as well, right? Mm. And that's personally affecting, you know, fewer people, but it's definitely noisy as well.
Yeah, I think there's been a disconnect there. People haven't realized that the techniques that we use to obtain that material could be used against them. And that kind of surprises me. People tend to regard celebrities as living in a completely different planet. But, you know, they're using the same phone you are, right?
Yeah, I think that's precisely the point, though. I mean, you know, you look at celebrities, they're not representative of the, you know, the kinds of people that should also be aware of this type of issue, but, you know, maybe aren't, if that makes sense. Like they look at them as being on top of a mountain or, as you say, on a different planet.
Yeah, now what I have noticed too is, particularly in the US, the commentariat really flapping their arms around. I mean, we just heard that in that montage at the top of the show.
Yeah.
You know, they really are freaking out. We've got, you know, news announcers saying, well, you know, millions of people affected, including me, grumble, grumble. You know, my bank had to reissue my card. And then the other bloke, you know, screaming about not being able to remember his passwords. The vibe I get from the commentariat is one of frustration. They're frustrated at not really understanding the issues, and they're frustrated by the consequences of what's happening as well, but they don't know what to do about it. And truthfully, after 14 years around security, I don't either.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I think the other part of that as well is that, you know, the media will talk about, you know, the mass media in particular, they'll talk about the things that are going to get the attention of their market, right? So the fact that, you know, again, it'd be interesting to see the number of news stories relating to, you know, cybersecurity breaches or all the other things this year compared to years prior, because it feels to me like that's accelerated as well. Mm. You know, at some point, the mass media has decided that this is a really cool thing to talk about. It's the kind of thing that will actually get the attention of their viewers. Which, you know, that's a reflection of the fact that more people are actually paying attention, because if it wasn't, then they'd stop talking about it.
Yeah, but I mean, we look back at the Albert Gonzalez crew. This was a guy who stole something like 170 million card details between, I think it was 05 and 07. And there was an awful lot of news interest around there. And we thought, well, yep, chip and pin, right? And here we are 7 years later and it hasn't happened. We saw in 2011 Lulzsec getting headlines all over the world and everyone was scared of the hacktivists and Anonymous. And I got to say, though, at that point, the industry did actually change, right? We've seen a whole bunch of people come into it, right? So we did see an actual concrete change there. I think the problem we're dealing with in 2014, and that's what makes subsequent change harder, is we're dealing with a skills shortage now. After, you know, Lulzsec made, you know, the security business hot property and got everyone a pay rise, and, you know, I know plenty of people who have swimming pools and nice cars now who didn't previously, thanks to Lulzsec. You know, where do we go from here? Because at this point, we've sort of hit the capacity constraint of the industry, right? Which is why businesses like yours are succeeding, which is why companies like Veracode are planning to IPO. It's all about automation and outsourcing and crowdsourcing now, because even your outsourcers can't hire people. But what other solutions? Where else can we look for solutions?
Yeah, well, and just to pile in on that, I completely agree. You know, another data point around that is the merger between Accuvant and Fishnet over here under the Blackstone Group. Like that was, you know, that's a substantial amount of money that's gone into that deal. And the, you know, part of the thing that I think is confusing to folks that look on at that is, well, okay, this is an old model. But, you know, the fact that there is a skills shortage, the fact that the demand for this type of work, these type of people is increasing, means it's something that is not going to go away in a hurry unless it's disrupted by, you know, newer models, if that makes sense.
Hopefully, I'm guessing you're hoping it's yours. But tell us more about that merger for people in other markets who might not be familiar with, you know, what each of those companies actually do.
They're a combination of value-added resellers. So they're going through and reselling other people's stuff. So, you know, be that software, tin, whatever else, all focused around security though. And then, you know, doing things like, you know, providing resources to install and do training and all that kind of thing. That's part of where they make their money. But they also both have fairly substantial consulting arms going in and doing things like, you know, penetration testing, security architecture. I believe that you know, there's some compliance stuff that they do in there as well. So call it your standard value-added reseller, if that makes sense. But obviously, you know, two of the larger ones in North America. No one ever expected these two companies to merge because, you know, prior to them joining forces, they were pretty intense rivals in the market. And my read on it is that they've got contracts, they've got, you know, existing relationships with customers. That, you know, if you combine those, there's the ability to basically, you know, deepen those existing contracts, but also pull the ones that, you know, aren't necessarily common to the companies together. And when you do that, you've got the ability to basically improve the efficiency of how you're, you know, going out and selling to those customers, but also how you're delivering services as well.
I can't see the skills shortage getting better anytime soon. With respect, I don't see the outsourced bug bounty providers being able to really fill the entire gap. So what's going to happen? I mean, are we just going to see more and more spiraling salaries, more and more ownage, more and more mayhem, chaos?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, obviously there's things that lend themselves to crowdsourcing and there's things that don't, right? But part of what we're seeing pretty regularly out of the whole bug bounty thing is it's actually drawing people out of, you know, it's drawing folks that have the ability to contribute meaningfully to the security industry that aren't doing that at the moment. And they start to, you know, dip their toe into this type of thing.
It's a good path in for sure, you know, but I mean, bug crowd can't admin my firewall or design my network, you know?
No. That's probably true. I don't know. We've tried to do that before. I'm not sure that we ever will. spiraling salaries in terms of, you know, as the demand increases and scarcity continues, you know, that's going to go up. I think probably the other thing that'll happen, and you know, this will be interesting when it does, is the opportunity or the desire for companies to actually upskill their existing IT resources to start putting on security hats in different areas. You know, I know a lot of companies that kind of do that already. So you've got your security team, but then you've got the people within the company that have, you know, they've got the security kind of bent, and the folks that are working in InfoSec know that. You know, what we're starting to see, or what we've seen around a fair bit, is organizations actually starting to lean on those resources to basically leverage them. As well as, you know, having dedicated security people, if that makes sense.
Mm-mm. So tell us about your year as the CEO of Bug Crowd, because, you know, you're a relatively new business. It seems like things are going pretty well for you. I mean, are you guys still taking investment, or are you, you know, living off your own revenues? I mean, what's the sector actually doing? Because there's a lot of players as well.
Yeah, well, it's gotten, I mean, 2014 for us was the year we, basically the market got kind of busy all of a sudden. You know, in 2013, we were basically out there on our own, going out and, you know, talking about this idea and getting customers and doing all the things. You know, this year we've had a number of companies basically join, you know, a number of them get funded and so on. And, you know, we're approaching what we do at a higher level, each in quite unique ways, if that makes sense. But overall, from the market's perspective, if it walks like a duck, looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck, right? So, you know, a lot of new companies started. I think that's really the main thing that happened. The number of organizations that are adopting this model publicly and running, you know, things like responsible disclosure programs and public bug bounties, that definitely accelerated. There's companies that have come into the space doing this type of thing for themselves that, you know, have obviously been thinking about this for quite some time, but, you know, needed some sort of catalyst to actually jump in and start.
And of course, you guys have actually pushed into the enterprise market now, so it's not just your big online brands that you're trying to run these bounties for. You're talking about, you know, bread and butter InfoSec teams working for, you know, banks, insurance companies, things like that, right?
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's where I was going with that. So really the way we look at the market is, you know, if you draw it out as a spectrum, you've got kind of the internet tech companies and the folks that want to run public programs down one end, and then you've got basically your banks and so on up the other end. Up the end that's populated by the banks and the more risk sensitive organizations, they don't want to run a bug bounty in the sense that Facebook's running one. But, you know, because of the skills shortage, and I think just because of the sense that the economics and the resourcing of the bug bounty model makes, they're trying to figure out how to appropriate it to what they're already doing, right? Which is, you know, what we've seen, those customers are the ones that we deal with privately, and you're not going to see them on the website. We don't talk about who they are and so on. But the kinds of industries that we've seen become customers of BugCrowd for that purpose over 2014 have been quite interesting. You know, we're talking financial services, we're talking retail. We're talking, you know, large software companies and so on.
What are you looking forward to in 2015? What do you think is going to happen next year in this wonderful industry of ours?
The obvious answer is, you know, will breaches accelerate, or will you know, the holiday season and kind of new budgets kicking in Q1 start to reduce that? You know, that's anyone's guess. My thought around that is that, you know, obviously the attackers are not letting up. I mean, it'll be interesting to see. I think the fact that a lot of the retail breaches we saw earlier on in the year were campaigns that were conducted over this particular time frame that we're in right now, so heading into the, you know, Black Friday, the Christmas buying season, and so on.
Otherwise known as when I'm about to go on holidays.
Otherwise known as, yeah, well, that's been an interesting thing about moving to the US, because, you know, pretty much everything ramps up into the end of the year, whereas in Australia, obviously, everyone basically clocks off just after Melbourne Cup and returns in January.
yeah,
I'll get my head around that a bit. But, you know, I mean, you know, what's going on right now? Like, if that's an MO that was successful for the kind of folks that were behind some of the retail breaches we saw come out this year, you know, what are the kinds of things that are most likely happening right now? That we'll hear about, you know, in Q1 or Q2 of next year. I mean, are the defenses, obviously, the fact that so much of that stuff happened, there's been a bunch of spend that's gone into defensive measures and different things like that.
So we only have to wait a couple of months to see if it's worked.
Well, exactly right. Yeah, that's the thing. Like, people, you know, there's going to be organizations that didn't do anything, and the question will be, you know, does history repeat for them?
Well, the really interesting thing will be to see if the people who have spent the money and the people who haven't spent the money still get owned just as hard as each other, right? So that's a question that I'm keen to see answered. Casey Ellis, that's all we're going to have time for, mate. Thank you very much for joining us. And, you know, thank you very much for your sponsorship of the Risky Business Podcast over 2014. And we'll be chatting again next year.
Yeah, well, thanks for putting it on, Pat. We appreciate what you do. Have a good Christian New Year's.
Casey Ellis there of BugCrowd. Big thanks to him and BugCrowd for its support of the Risky Business Podcast in 2014. And if you are based outside of Australia, I should probably explain that Cup Day is a reference to the Melbourne Cup, which is run in early November. And it is true, things tend to wind down in Australia when it gets warmer. And that is it for this week's show. And that is it for Risky Business for another year, 8 years down now. I've really enjoyed myself over the course. I hope you've gotten as much pleasure out of listening to the show as I got putting it together. And I hope you all have a great month or so. I'll be back in mid-January. This week's feature track is Wait Until Tomorrow by Bomba. You can get it on iTunes. But until next year, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Tomorrow. It doesn't matter where I turn. Walk away from fire and I still get burned. How did my luck change and go downhill? I done my time and I paid your bill. Tomorrow.
dance that they mix. Just 24 simple hours, everything's going wrong. Now everything's coming up flowers. I'm glad I waited. I'm glad I waited till tomorrow, 'cause she finally called.